Watch the game, Andy. Watch the game. She's good. She can move.
It's not right. It's unnatural. Doesn't even look nice.
It's modern, Andy. It's good. Modern girls, modern boys. It's tremendous. Look.
Hello and welcome to the Sound of Football podcast. I'm Graham Sibley, and as usual, I'm joined by Jan Bilton.
Hello.
And Terry DeFellin.
Hello.
Jan, you're happy, aren't
you? I'm very happy.
You're very happy, aren't you? You're all going to Wembley again.
Again, yeah. It's only the second time in 2 months.
Yes. Are you happy you're going to Wembley?
I'm happy we're going to Wembley. I'm warming to the idea now because we're playing Charlton again. This will be my fourth time at Wembley watching Sunderland, and the previous three occasions we've been beaten. The first of those occasions was that epic playoff final against Charlton where we drew 4-4 and went out in penalties, I think 7-6. I made my son watch that again the other day just to get him ready. Yeah. Of course, in his world, he goes to Wembley every other month, which he thinks is great.
Yeah, I'm sure he's got his own seat there now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's just saying, we're going to Wembley again, Dad. Yeah, that'll be good.
I'm going to go and sit in the Henry Bilton stand.
Yeah, I think he thinks it's something of the norm, and it's just, I think it's lost all novelty. I got home today and said, guess what, boy? We're going to Wembley again. And he was like,
Again.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm very excited. Hopefully we can get one over on Charlton. I thought we did really well in both legs of the playoff semi-final. Really hard-fought and, at times, quite violent game against Portsmouth down at Fratton Park.
Including the fans,
which was awful.
Everyone was getting involved. Yeah,
everyone was giving us a kick. But in the end, it doesn't matter because we're going to Wembley and they aren't.
Yes, indeed. And it'll give us half an hour of content next week, won't
it? That's very true, yes.
Yes.
In fact, we can just stay at home and Jan can just talk into the microphone for half an hour.
Yes.
Or cry into it, depending on what happens.
Probably course, be the latter.
You were watching the Bundesliga.
Speaking of crying.
Yes. Less said about that.
Yeah. It was a great performance, great season by Borussia Dortmund, but just short, just by a game or two, sadly. But there it is. At least they took him to the final game of the season, so that's pretty decent.
Of course, listeners, the season is winding down. Everything is coming to an end. Some good ends, some pretty woeful ends as well. But, of course, we had the cup final on Sunday. Personally, I was doing the double screen thing. I was watching the FA Cup final on the big telly with the sound up. But on my phone, I had the Women's Champions League final on. Lyon versus Barcelona. It was a bit one-sided. It wasn't as one-sided as the scoreline suggested.
Really?
I would suggest. So Barcelona certainly had opportunities, very, very good opportunities to score. Lyon's fourth in a row. Well, I don't know too much about it. So what I do, I thought, we've got a World Cup coming up. So let's get an expert in. I went out and I found an expert.
A proper expert,
a real expert.
Yeah.
We're all a little bit nervous. Have you noticed that we're all wearing, you know, our smarter shirts?
I know,
we're
exactly.
all wearing collars.
Yes. We're all wearing collars today.
Because we're actually wearing trousers today. which is a lovely surprise.
Yes.
Anyway, so...
Yeah, thanks, Jan.
That's okay.
But yes, listeners, welcome to the show, Patti LaBella from the Women's World Football Show.
Hi, thank you. You guys are nervous. I'm nervous, believe me.
Great. We'll all be nervous together then.
I was like, you guys are so knowledgeable and you know so much. I was like, I'm a little intimidated. So I'm just a dodo sometimes. So I'll do my best to keep up with you guys.
Patti, obviously on your podcast, you've been doing your podcast now for 6 years. You've got hundreds of podcasts under your belt. And the list of names that you've had on there is, well, it's like a telephone directory of women's football. Listeners, if you've not come across Patti's podcast, we're going to put a link of it up on our website. And I really suggest you listen to it. If you're going to take any interest in the Women's World Cup this year, and hopefully after you've listened to today's podcast, you'll be aching to go for it, because there's so much information on Patti's podcast that you'll be able to completely immerse yourself into it. Well, Patti, what a week it's been in women's football.
Really? I've never heard you say that before. That's awesome.
she's done you.
She's done you.
I do like, well... Yeah. I do like to keep things fresh. Patty, I assume you watched the Champions League final.
I watched parts of it.
Yeah.
As you know, I'm in California, so a lot of it came over very slow and other things going on. So, yeah, I did watch parts of it. And like you said, it wasn't as one-sided as you would think from looking at the scoreline, like a lot of times when watching these games. But it was kind of like the Atta Hegerberg show.
Oh, yeah.
She scored another hat trick for Lyon. And, of course, like you said, four Women's Champions League in a row, 2015 to 2019. Pretty amazing.
Every Champions League between the last World Cup and this one that's just about to start. That's what you call domination, isn't it? But I suppose in the men's game, we've had Real Madrid. They would have done that if they hadn't stuffed up against Ajax, I suppose, wouldn't they?
That's so, perfectly true. Yeah, that's true. But Lyon's record domestically is also equally impressive.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, they're the team to beat. And a lot of people say it's because of Atta Hegerberg, but I kind of disagree because they have such a stacked lineup. I mean, everybody who's anybody in women's football wants to play at Lyon, not only because they treat the players really well, they pay them really well, but, of course, you're going to be winning silverware. So that's the draw. We see players from all over the world go and play in Lyon because of that.
England's Lucy Bronze is playing for Lyon. Actually, she laid on one of the goals for Atta Hegerberg in that game. Fantastic cross. A lot of those goals came from the right wing. There seemed to be a huge amount of space for them to operate in. But killer crosses and a decent striker in the middle is always going to yield goals, isn't it?
Yeah, I wish I could watch more, especially in the French League. They really do have top quality teams. Everybody wants to go there to play for a reason.
Do you see any players from the U.S. making the trip to permanently play in Europe?
Oh, yeah. We've had actually my recent guest on our show, Crystal Dunn, for the U.S. Women's National Team. She played at Chelsea recently. We had Heather O'Reilly go over and play at Arsenal. As for France, we had a couple of them. Morgan Bryan went to play there. Megan Rapinoe played in France for a few seasons. It almost is, if you want to be the best in the world, you have to play in Europe at some time. I mean, it's just like the men's side, right? It's like we see the top players go over and play in Europe, whether they're playing in England or in France. And that's because you want to test yourself against the best and you want to play in these environments that you may not play on, in stateside. We have the NWSL here, and it's a fairly new league. But most of those players, most of the U.S.-based players have played over in Europe at one point or another. Crystal Dunn went over there because she wasn't getting the playing time. She was playing at Washington Spirit. She really didn't want to play there. She tried to get a trade. She couldn't get traded, so she went and played at Chelsea for a year, came back. North Carolina picked her up, and then they won the championship last year. So it really does help, I think. It helps with the confidence and helps with their skill set. If you talk to these players after they come back, they're like, they're so valuable what they learn when they go play either in England or in France or in Germany as well.
As someone from North America, what is the shape of women's football in Europe at the moment? Because I suppose a lot of people who perhaps only come into it for World Cups probably are aware of the stronger sides, but maybe less so of the stronger leagues. What would you say is the current shape of it?
Well, I think it's growing. You know, we talk about it all the time that the world of women's football is getting smaller because there's so many leagues popping up. I mean, they have a really great league in Iceland. Italy's league is picking up. Of course, Sweden has always had a really great league that attracts a lot of players. Now, England, I just read today that Barclays has become the first title sponsor of the FAWSL, which is awesome because that means more exposure, more money. I mean, when we look at the leagues from North America, when we look over to Europe, that's what we're looking at, really. We're looking at how is the support coming? You know, where's the support coming from? Where are the sponsorships coming from? Where's the money coming from? Is there money? A lot of times there's not. You know, and then we see the trickle down of the lower leagues, like you were saying, like off air. You know, you have some of these lower leagues, especially in England, and they're so important because that's where we're going to see like the growth of the, it's all going to bubble up to the top, I guess. And that's kind of what we look at. We look at the growth. When we look at the Frauen-Bundesliga, which has been around for so many years and so many great players have gone over to Germany and play there, we're still seeing kind of a lapse in attendance. The attendance isn't up, but it's become more respected over the years to where it's not, you know, the women players aren't looked down upon like they used to be. Germany has had a kind of a hard row as far as the respectability. But, you know, they still have the big sponsorship. Wolfsburg obviously has the Volkswagen and So that's kind of what we look at when we're looking at these leagues in Europe. Of course, the players that go there are great. They get our attention. And to see someone like us, like I said, Hegerberg going to Lyon, being in Lyon for so many years and doing what she does, raising that level of notoriety, I guess, and exposure, which is something that we always try to get. We try to get exposure because people will look at women's football and say, well, it's not as good as the men's, or it's not as fast, or it's not as physical. And that's all good and well, but they have to understand that women's football is very different. It's a different game. And so it's almost like a classic game where there's a lot of passing. Some teams you will find that'll press high, like the United States national team is a team that is very physical and is trying to get more like Japan, where they're doing like the 1-2 touch and get rid of the ball really quickly. So the styles are different, but I think it's just fun on its own.
You've mentioned Ada Hegerberg there, and obviously she's not going to the World Cup. Now, it seems to be unclear. What is your take on the whole business?
Well, of course, she's a FIFA Player of the Year. Some people compare her to Messi, which I think is kind of unfair as a 23-year-old. But you know what? If you ask somebody at the Norwegian FA what the deal is, they probably couldn't tell you. Because all the things that I've read, and I've been trying to get some information, it seems very unclear as to why she's boycotting the national team or why she's decided not to play for the national team. She says it's because of the, you know, unfairness. Some people say it's pay. Talk about Lyon paying their players very well. She's one of the highest paid players on Lyon, I think, in the whole French league. But, you know, I don't know. I've heard so many different things, probably like you. And yeah. Like I said, the things that I've heard is she's not very clear about it. I don't know if that's Norwegian FA's way of saying we don't want to deal with it. But, you know, because I would imagine if you're foregoing your national team career, you'd want to be crystal clear as to why. Is it pay? Is it you don't respect us? That's kind of vague when you say, well, I'm fighting for respectability. And you can't, that's not a real tangible thing. You know, it's like, well, why aren't you respected? Tell us why. Is it pay? Is it monetary? Is it conditions? Is it training? Tell us a little bit more. So, you know, I don't know if she has and they just don't want to say.
It's interesting because Graham pointed this out on Twitter recently, actually. The host broadcaster for UK is the BBC. Obviously, their marketing team, they don't know that Ada Hegerberg is not going because they're using her shirt as a part of the publicity for the forthcoming tournament and their coverage of it. Perhaps there is in the dark. Do you suppose that what could be happening is that at some point she might change her mind and come back in? Or do you think that without really knowing what the problem is it possible that, in fact, it is something that's resolvable in time? Or do you think it's past that point now?
Well, is it her choice? But I saw that promotion a little bit different than a lot of people. I saw that promotion as them showing her shirt. Obviously, they didn't show her playing, as saying, you know, she's still the greatest player and we're going to pay homage to her because she's doing something that she believes in and we respect that. That was my view. And I saw people were saying, oh, they don't even know that she's like they know. You know, they they know, you know, and it's just, I think it was just that was my own take on it. But, I, you know, at this point, I'm not sure if it's even her, if it's even up to her now. I just think it's a shame because if you look at her club career and she's done so much and she's regarded as the best player in the world, she's really kicking herself, I guess, because she could be stacking up the international goals. You know, I mean, she could really be doing a lot for Norway as far as, like, we talk about exposure just by racking up the international goals. And she's not even on the list of top 10, I think, international goals. So, I mean, right now, I mean, what Christine Sinclair is doing in Canada is she will break Abby Wambach's all-time goal-scoring record. She's at 181. I mean, Ada Hegerberg has scored over 250 club goals. But I think if she were on the international level, she would definitely be up in that at least top 20, and she's not even there. So what can she be doing, you know, for Norway if she was kind of chasing what we call chasing Abby, you know, chasing that number one all-time leading goal scorer. Christine Sinclair for Canada, she's like, I mean, if you follow women's soccer, you're following her right now because I think she's like 3 goals behind the record. Behind her is Mia Hamm, and then you have like all the greats, Bridget Prince from Germany and Marta and Carly Lloyd. I mean, she can be up there, and she's only, like I said, she's only 23. So imagine if she were playing international. I mean, she hasn't played for Norway in since 2017. If she was playing, just imagine she could really be pushing for that record. You know, I think it's a sad thing. I give her a lot of credit because she's doing this from the heart. It's something she believes in. But at the same time, if you want respectability, really, and if you want your country to be built up as far as women's soccer goes, you want to build up women's soccer in your country, then you want to be playing for your country. And if you're not, then you want to be crystal clear as to why you're not.
It's interesting that her sister is also refusing to play, isn't she, Adrien? So
you know,
I don't know whether the issue does sit with the players rather than with the, or certainly the refusal sits with the players rather, and they may hold issue with their own FA, and that's what the issue is, rather than the FA having a problem with them. Or it being some elaborate marking exercise.
It's difficult enough, I suppose, for the leading women in women's football to actually get decent, lucrative contracts. But the ones at the top do actually earn quite good money from sponsorship. Abby Wambach obviously got a good deal with Nike, as did Alex Morgan and Carly Lloyd. Obviously, with someone who is marketable, like Hegerberg, because she's scoring loads of goals and she makes the game look good. And yet she's not going to be at the biggest stage, and she probably won't be at the next biggest stage because Norway aren't going to qualify for the Olympics, are they?
Hegerberg is unconventional. She's unconventional in the way that she plays. She's got the best of everything. She's physically and mentally strong, like way above her peers. But with that comes an unconventional personality too. I think she's marketable, even in her quirkiness and things like that. But everybody's different, and maybe she's just happy playing on the club team. I was talking, actually, before we came on air, I had Christine Lilly, who's actually in the fourth spot of all-time leading goal scorers. She had a 23-year career with the United States women's soccer team. And we were talking about that, about how the stress level of playing for a national team, people don't realize that every day is a battle. Like, you're always battling for your spot. You're never safe. You never feel safe. And so that those stress levels are so high. If you don't have what it takes mentally to do that day in and day out, then you're not going to be there. You know, it's just not going to happen for you. And it's an interesting thing. You know, it's easy for us to, sometimes I have to take myself off of my couch. You know, it's easy to kind of try to figure out what's going on in these players' heads or whatever, but it really is a situation where, as much as we try to figure it out, it's a crazy world. I can't even pretend to understand it.
Well, we've talked about a player that's not going. Let's just concentrate now on the players that actually are going. So we'll talk about the teams. And I suppose what we've really got to do is start with the USA, because obviously you are American, so, and they are the world champions. They do go in as favourite, I'm guessing. They are the world number ones. Now, what I noticed, I was looking through the squads today. A lot of those very, very high cap players aren't there this time. There are still a lot of experience in that US squad, but they certainly rack up the caps, don't they? I mean, I think between this World Cup and the last World Cup, I think Carly Lloyd's put on 72 caps, and I think equivalent in the England squad was about 30. They really do rack up a lot of games. Is that a deliberate ploy from the management?
US soccer loves to put on in the past, I would venture to say that in the past there have been a lot of quote unquote cupcake type friendlies that they'll bring in, like Haiti and teams like that, you know, that are not even ranked in the FIFA rankings. But over the past few years, I mean, since 2015, they've come up with a couple of tournaments. They have She Believes Cup and the Tournament of Nations. That's helped, of course, with the cap situation. And they're always playing friendlies. I mean, then, of course, when you have victory tours, like they always like to do the victory tours. And leading up to World Cup, they've done like the kickoff series. And then before and after the Olympics, you know, it's like the kickoff series of the Olympics. So they do bring in the crowds. So for U.S. soccer, they are very lucrative as far as bringing in the turnstile. You know, even for meaningless friendlies, I was at the South Africa match last month, and they brought in, 23,000 people. New Zealand, they just played last week. They had over 30,000. So, you know, as long as they can continue to do that, they're going to continue having friendlies. But one thing we have seen since 2015 and before that is we're seeing the U.S. go overseas more and play. You know, they have played friendlies in France, in Sweden. So they're venturing out more, you know, beyond the borders.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that that's, you know, possibly because of the lucrative aspect of it, or do you think that that's because they maybe recognise that the field is growing stronger and the standard is rising and they need to get out to these other countries, other pitches, other stadiums, and acclimatise themselves to that so that when they do go to, you know, Europe to play in a World Cup, that or indeed in an Olympics, not this time but next time, that that they're ready and prepared for that kind of environment and that kind of challenge?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, and I give all the credit to Jill Ellis. I mean, she's really, not only has she she's given players first caps. I mean, I think it's like over 30 in the past 4 years that she's given players first caps, which is amazing. She's also bringing the team out more. And she's also, I think, responsible for these tournaments as well, bringing England in and teams like Japan and Australia into the United States to play a tournament style. But definitely Jill Ellis wants her team playing overseas. I think that's why they did that. They did their they did France, England, and I think they went to Sweden and played. So they wanted to kind of assimilate that. And playing in France, of course, was a no-brainer because that's what they're trying to get used to, playing France in France, you know, with the crowd, and the stadium was packed. So that definitely is something I totally expect to see more of past this World Cup.
So I'm going to put you on the line here. Now, we don't make predictions. Uh-oh. We don't make predictions on the podcast.
No.
So we got guests on to make them for us.
Oh, gosh.
That's what we do. Yeah, it's very harsh. First question is, are the US going to retain their title?
You know, it's interesting. If you look at this team and, you know, from top to bottom, and then you see who's sitting on the bench, the bench basically could be a first team on any other country. Like, they are so deep, but they do have a weakness, and the weakness is the outside back situation. That's been something that they haven't been able to solidify. We talked about Crystal Dunn is a natural forward who they pushed to, and she plays forward for her club team. She played forward at Chelsea. She played forward a little bit for the U.S. Women's National Team, and there was just a big hole at outside back. Jill has tried to put in other players, tried to drop players back, tried to move players around. That still isn't set right now as the outside back situation. She brought in Allie Krieger, who was there in 2015 in the Women's World Cup in 2015, played every minute of that tournament. And now we haven't seen her since 2017. She just dropped off the radar. Now, 2 months before Women's World Cup, Jill Ellis brought her back because she was their premier outside back. That's scary to me. If you still are not sure and you're bringing in a player who hasn't played for the national team for 2 years because you were trying to find a fast outside back that, you know, could do some different things. The other weakness for U.S. Women's National Team is the goalkeeper. I mean, Alyssa Nair is the number one keeper, but she has no experience on the big stage. Last time we, of course, in the Olympics in Rio, it was Hope Solo. And Hope Solo was the goalkeeper. Alyssa Nair was her backup, never saw any playing time, obviously. Hope Solo was unceremoniously sacked. And so Alyssa Nair has never really been tested at that big stage, on a big stage. So this will be her first time. And I've seen her, she's not real, you don't get really confident. Like with Hope Solo and goal, you are confident. Like she was going to stop everything. Alyssa Nair, she makes me nervous, to put it that way. So if you can penetrate the back line, you could probably score a goal or two on Alyssa Nair, and especially with the lack of cohesiveness on that, the outside backs. So can the U.S. win? I think so. I think they can win. But at the same time, I just see, like you said, like women's football is just becoming so much better. Everybody's kind of rising up to the top. And we've seen it when the U.S. play teams that are of their caliber, they work really hard to get a result. They actually, when they played that friendly in France, they actually lost. And that was a problem. I think it was a direct problem because of that outside back. Jill Ellis brought in a college player. Eugenie Le Sommer, like, just took her to school. It was just not a contest. So we'll see. I don't like to make predictions either, and I don't want to seem like a homer. I don't want to seem like a homer and say, yeah, USA, rah, you know, but I do well, like the USA.
Do actually have you recorded now?
Yeah, it's going to be all edited.
Yep.
But I do like England. I think England has a really good shot, and I think that, of course, Japan, they have a young team, but they're still in contention. My dark horse is between Canada and Australia, but again, I don't know how well they'll do on that. Canada's always right there, you know. They're always kind of right there, but they just have a problem beating. Like, they can beat anybody lower than the 10th, and, you know, ranked in FIFA. But it's when they get into the top 10, they have a hard time with those top 10 teams.
I've had a look at the draw, and for Canada and Australia, they have a chance to go very, very deep, because I think that if it goes how we would expect it to go, they would be in the bottom half of the draw, them and Germany. Whereas I think France, England and the United States look mm-hmm. to be in the top half of the draw. France, the hosts, are on a collision course with the USA, I think, in the quarterfinals in Paris. Which is going to be one hell of a game. And Terry and I are going to that one, aren't we?
Well, we're going to that.
Oh, are you?
We're going to that quarterfinal. Oh. Whether or not France there. Or the US will be kind enough to contrive to be there with us. I don't know. But yes, we are indeed.
We are indeed going to that. So well, we're hoping for that to happen. I think it's...
You are. I'm not.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm actually going to be there for the group stage. And then we have some other people going for the knockouts. But yeah, I'll be there for the first 2 weeks.
Okay. Oh, grand. It's good that you're going to get to go over there. That's fantastic. Stick out for the whole tournament, though.
I know. I had other obligations, mainly my real job.
Damn those real jobs, eh?
Yeah, damn those real jobs. But I'm looking forward to USA versus Sweden. That's the one I think that a lot of the U.S. fans are looking forward to, obviously because of what happened in the Olympics when Sweden kind of parked the bus. And it ended up in 0-0, and then Sweden won on PKs. And also Sweden's head coach, Pia Sundhagen, used to be the head coach of the U.S. women's national team. So there's a lot of little rivalry going there. And, of course, Hope Solo lost her job because of things that she said about Sweden. So we have a little grudge against Sweden, so that should be a good game.
That should be tasty.
Yeah, yeah.
Quite a few of our listeners are from Australia. And I note that quite a few members of the Australia squad play in the NWSL, so I'm assuming that you're probably quite familiar with them. And I guess Sam Kerr is the player that sticks out amongst those. Could you tell us a little bit about them and their prospects?
Oh, yeah. I love Australia. I love the Matildas. And Sam Kerr is one of the most exciting players around. In fact, there's the Otto Hedinburg camp, and then there's the Sam Kerr camp. There are many people who believe that Sam Kerr is the best player in the world. And she's very energetic. You know, she's theatrical. She just has a fun way about her. I think all the Aussies do. But, you know, she'll give you the backflip, you know, when she scores. And so she's just one of those players that is so dynamic. I mean, she comes up from the back really fast. Juke and jive, you know, and she comes up with the almost impossible goals on wicked angles, really. So she's super fun to watch. They also have a forward by the name of Caitlin Ford I would keep an eye on. And their back line is just completely solid. Steph Catley and Katrina Gori. And they just have a really great team. The only thing about Australia is it's kind of troubling because I don't know if you heard about this, but they sacked their head coach like in February. Like, why would you do that leading up to the Women's World Cup? And it's still not really clear as to why they did it. Alan Stajic, he basically built this team. He was there in 2015. He was a new manager. He came in. He cut a few of their veterans right before Women's World Cup. That didn't make him really popular. But then he just built up. You know, he built up this young squad with Sam Kerr as the captain. He was doing a really great job. The rumor that I heard is there's a young 16-year-old on the Australian team named Mary Fowler. I don't know if you've heard of her. She has a double citizenship with Ireland. And her brother and sister play for the Ireland youth teams. So what I heard was, and this is not substantiated by any way, just inside rumor, but she, her father wanted her to play for Australia. And there was this internal struggle between the Australian Federation and the Irish Federation as to who was going to get her on their team. Stajic didn't really want her on the team. She's 16 years old. She's got a lot of growing to do. And so all of a sudden he gets canned. Mary Fowler's on the team. Now she's named onto the World Cup squad. So there, I mean, you could take it for what it's worth. It's kind of a little, there's always drama. There's always drama in football, but it's extra drama in women's football, it seems like. But yeah, so Mary Fowler, you might want to keep an eye on. She's a really big kid. We got to see her when she played here, when Australia was here playing for Tournament of Nations. So at 16, she's really big. She's a strong forward. We'll see how she fits into that group because she's fairly new into that group. I mean, she's one of the younger, obviously a younger player, but hasn't been with the team for very long. So we have to keep an eye on her. But they should have no problem getting out of their group. They have Italy, Brazil, and Jamaica. Brazil's not what they used to be. Italy is probably going to give them a little bit of a run for their money. Jamaica's the debutante. So I think Australia's sitting really well in their group.
Canada have got the Netherlands, haven't they, in their group?
Yeah, and that's their big test will be the Netherlands. New Zealand, I think, is also in their group, which they always seem to face New Zealand. Canada and New Zealand have this little rivalry going because of their head coaches. They used to, Canada's head coach was John Herdman, who used to coach New Zealand. Now Tom Sormani is coaching at New Zealand. He used to be assistant coach in Canada. So there's all these little inner things going on. But I think the Netherlands and Canada, that's going to be a big test for Canada. And I think Cameroon is also in that group. That's a fun group.
I was just going to say, what do you think of England's prospects? Because England have got a tough group as well with Japan. And of course, the old enemy, Scotland. What do you think of England's chances?
And what do you think of Scotland's chances?
Yeah.
Well, see, for Scotland, for the Women's World Cup, it's the first time they've been there. So they're the debutantes too there. But England, I think England doesn't have a problem with this group. I mean, even with Japan, I never count Japan out. And the last time I saw them, they were really impressive, even though people were saying, well, this is a younger team. You know, they're a fairly young team. This is a different team than 2015. A lot of the players are different. But the last time I saw them, I was like, wow, this team is really good. What are they talking about? So I think that Scotland is not going to be a problem for England, Argentina as well. But Japan might be the sticking point. We can't underestimate Japan just with their style of play, their one-touch play. I mean, they're just so fast, and they sneak up on you, I'll tell you. They're crazy fast, and being young is not really a detriment, I don't think, in the Women's World Cup. I mean, if you've got a couple veterans, but you have a squad full of youngsters, I don't think that's a detriment at all. But this England squad is so good, and we had a chance to watch Rachel Daly and Jodie Taylor here in the NWSL, and they're just so fantastic. They've actually garnered a big fan base, especially Rachel Daly. Like, the fans love her, and anytime she's on, well, she actually just got a suspension for a bad conduct suspension, so she wasn't able to play last week. But the fans just love her. I mean, she blows up on social media. She's been really good, and she's played here in the States for a few years. I actually interviewed her a few years ago when she was playing in college, and she was playing the summer league here in California. So she's one of those players that, you know, just basically came out. I think she came out of like Doncaster or Lincoln City, something like that. And then she just rose through the ranks because she's such a hard worker. Went to college here in the United States. Like I said, played summer league here. Didn't really go home. I remember asking her, like, don't you miss home? Like, you're never home. And she's like, well, you know, I'm trying to make the national team. That was like 4 years ago. So, and now here she is. So we almost have like a pridefulness when we see a player like Rachel Daly make the squad, because it's like, you know, we're proud of her. And it seems kind of strange, but it's, you know, when you watch a player grow up, especially like on your home soil, it doesn't matter what country they're from, you're always going to root for them.
I suppose with the college system in the States, that's always going to give the US an advantage when you've got such a groundswell of talent. The hundreds and hundreds of teams you've got there going through that period where you're going to get the best coming out and going into US teams. I suppose that's one thing where until we get systems in place where there is going to be a constant supply of talent, it's always going to be hard to maintain.
Sure. But quality. It's interesting because UEFA, I mean, obviously England have been doing a lot of, with the English FA, have been doing a lot of work in that regard for a very long time without getting too dark. There is something of a stain about English women's football going back all the way because it was banned from
Yeah.
Sometime before the Second World War through to the 1970s, the women's game. And so there's an awful lot of investment, remedial investment that needs to be put in to make up for all that lost time and missed opportunities. But it's also interesting that UEFA announced just prior to the Champions League final, new investment in improving, increasing the number of women players across the UEFA continent over the next 5 or 6 years. So it does look like that there's money being spent now, which is the important thing. And yeah, and as Patty points out with the FAWSL Barclays tie-in as well, which is very encouraging also because the FAWSL made the courageous step to move to the winter from the summer and to sort of which you know could have backfired. But it looks like if that's in the basis that that's actually turned out to be a decent decision.
And something interesting, too, is we're seeing almost a reverse of the college system when we talk about the college system. We have a couple of players on the U.S. team that actually forego their college experience. Lindsay Horan decided not to go to college, and she went and played at PSG. And then she got picked up by the U.S. Senior team. And Mallory Pugh, who's on the squad, too, for World Cup, she had a full-set scholarship to UCLA, and she turned it down to play pro. So we're starting to see kind of a little bit of that. And a Canadian, the young Canadian player, Jordan Heidema, she had a chance to go to any college she wanted to and decided to go play in France as well. So we're starting to kind of see a little bit of a reverse, like players are getting to the point where, and again, this is rarities, but it's more than we've seen in the past, where it was just a straight shot through high school, college, and then pros. Now we're starting to see players actually have the choice whether they want to go to college or not. And a lot of it has to do with, like, what you're talking about, the investments in the pro teams. And do I want to make my money right now? Mal Pugh signed a contract with Nike. I think she signed with Nike. She's making tons of money. If she went to college, she couldn't do that because the NCAA rules say that you can't sign contracts and make money if you're playing collegiately. So if you've got the choice, I'm going to make my bank right now and I'll get my education later. You know, they basically have that choice now, which is, you know, good either way. You know, college isn't for everybody.
Well, obviously we've tried to pack as much as we can into the time that we have. And I have a feeling that we could talk deep into the night or deep into the afternoon as far as Pat is concerned. But I think we're going to have to wind it up. I was going to go on about sort of talking about the difference in playing styles and everything, but I don't think we have to, because I think if you're not invested enough to watch these games, then fine, you know, wait till August when the men's game comes back. We'll stay up to the middle of the night and watch a Copa America. But I think it's going to be a cracking tournament. And all these games, 2014 tournament, was a yeah, it's got that bonkers third place thing going on there, but you know, that just adds a bit more fun to it. There'll be loads of great games. There'll be loads of goals. There will be loads and loads of goals. I watched quite a lot of the last World Cup and I thought it was great. And I watched the Euros and I thought they were great recently, despite the fact that we didn't turn up against the Netherlands.
Yeah, but, hey, that was disappointing.
That was disappointing, yeah. But yeah.
But it's funny because we're very much men's football is what we talk about. And so you kind of look at the Women's World Cup as something to enjoy, but your emotional investment at the beginning is not perhaps as much as it would be for the Men's World Cup. But when we got to that game against the Netherlands, I was just bereft. I just thought, well, you know, this is just such an opportunity to... I know Leica Martens is an outstanding player, but really, you know, all, as a team, as a unit, I think England just had the measure of them at the Netherlands and really just had to just apply themselves. And this happens, though, in football, and it happens in short format tournaments. And that's why they're so great. And that's why I'm really looking forward to this one. And of course, you can't take anything for granted because you have one duff game and the chances are that's you going home.
Well, the tournament begins on the 7th of June and you'll be able to watch it on BBC in the UK. Check local providers.
Fox Sports 1, I think, in the US.
Yeah, Fox Sports has a great lineup of announcers, of former players and current players. And they have a Luko, I think, from England is going to be on the Fox broadcast as well. And Kelly Smith.
Yeah. Oh, excellent.
The great Kelly Smith.
We'll probably have Alex Scott, won't we? Doing an awful lot of the punditry.
Almost certainly, yeah.
She's been kind of doing the men's game over here for this season. She was a star in the Men's World Cup coverage for the BBC and continues to do men's punditry, and will almost certainly be doing the Women's World Cup. Well, it would be really weird if she didn't.
No, she certainly is.
But we also have some great pundits as well. Who watch Sue Smith, of course, who's done some great work, and Emma Hayes, who really many people feel should be the current England coach, but we have it on some authority that she's not interested in the job.
Well, Patty, thank you very much for coming along. As I say, Terry and I are going over to France, so when we come back, we'll catch up with you again, maybe, and tell you all about it
awesome.
And ask about how you got on out there as well.
Oh, I would love that. And thank you guys, too, for taking the time to talk about women's football. Not a lot of the times men's football podcasts or bloggers do that, so I really appreciate it that you guys are giving them a forum. It's important.
Yep, it's only taken us 376 podcasts to get a female guest on, but
don't congratulate us too much, really.
we're awful, awful people.
You should be damning us, really. Yeah. Really should be.
Yeah, but you're very kind to be so kind to us. We genuinely don't deserve it. But
yes, you can be kind and outraged at the same time. I think that's fair. But yes, thank you very much, Patty. I speak for the other two guys here.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, guys.
Well, we have got one more podcast that we're going to be bringing out next week. That's going to be our end of season show. And then in the summer, we'll probably have a few ones as well, because we're going to be going watching football. So I'm going to be at the Nations League, then going off to the Women's World Cup. But for now, from me, Graham Sibley, from Jan Bilton, and from Terry DeFellin, and from our special guest, Patty Labella, it's goodbye.
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 You can contact us through our website, sofpodcast.com, via Twitter, @soundoffootball, or on facebook.com/soundoffootball.
Yeah, USA, 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 USA.